Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. The subject is dysautonomia. That is an array, sort of a blanket term, which covers a wide array of conditions that people suffer from. We discussed a little bit what are some of the criteria for making the call for dysautonomia in part one. In part two with today's guest, Lauren Stiles, who is co-founder of Dysautonomia International. By training, she's an attorney, but she herself suffered dysautonomia at the age of 31 and has become a relentless researcher and advocate for looking for answers for individuals living with autonomic disorders. She enjoys collaborating with scientists to engage patients in the process of medical research from start to finish. And she herself has been invited to lecture on the subject at the National Institutes of Health and Duke University. So Lauren, what are some of the possible avenues of treatment or recovery for patients suffering from dysautonomia? I know it's a diverse group of conditions, so it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, right?
Right. I would say even within each individual diagnosis, there's a wide range of severity, and the prognosis differs based, on individual factors. But, after consulting with a doctor, because I don't want to have anybody trying to do this stuff at home without, checking with a doctor first. But there are a lot of non-pharmacological and pharmacological treatments that can help. There's really no magic cure for any type of dysautonomia. If you have an underlying disease causing it, treating the underlying disease would be important. But the symptomatic-focused treatments, non-pharmacological, probably the most common thing that patients with low blood pressure, patients with POTS, patients with fainting disorders, they're told to increase their salt and fluids. Mm-hmm. So while everyone else in the world is trying to eat less salt, these patients are trying to eat a lot of salt.
And you know what I find interesting is that often these patients they're very virtuous. They're very attuned to health information, and they don't salt their foods. They don't eat junk food. So they're getting a heck of a lot less salt than other folks, ironically.
Right. They thought they were doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And then when their fainting problems or their lightheadedness started, some doctor was like, nope, you have to eat a lot of salt. But it's important not to get your salt from junk food. Obviously, it's easy to eat salty potato chips, right? Because they're available, they're made. But you really want to get a healthy, high-salt diet going if you have this. And so that takes a little creativity. But your mouth, your tongue actually gets used to the high salt after a while. In the beginning, it tastes a little weird. But I can salt, everything from my hot chocolate to watermelon, avocados, and I barely taste it. And I actually, the original way of eating salad was really salad. The word salad comes from salt.
From cell or sal, right, yeah, in the Latin languages, right? Salted vegetables.
So salt on, I do a salad with, olive oil and salt on it, and it's actually delicious. But when you first start, if you're not used to eating that, you're like, oh, this is a little weird. But high salt, high fluids, 2 to 3 liters of hydrating fluids a day. So that doesn't include caffeinated beverages or sodas or coffee or alcohol. Those are most patients, some people can tolerate it, but most dysautonomia patients probably usually avoid alcohol because it's dehydrating. Exercise, as we talked about in the earlier segment, is very important for these patients.
But only certain types, right?
Well, usually they start out with the recumbent and reclined exercises, but the goal is to try to get back to more upright, normal type of exercises. Really, the goal is to be as functional as possible.
Right.
But everybody has different limits and abilities, and you have to just work with your doctor to figure out what's going to work best for you. Compression stockings, that's another a thing that is, if you've ever seen them in the hospital, like they give you those white TED stockings in the hospital, and they're kind of ugly and scratchy, and people are like, oh, do I really have to wear these?
Right.
But they come in all different colors now. They come in prints. They come in kinds that look cool for guys, like just look like athletic pants. They don't even look like stockings. So these help squeeze the legs and kind of push that blood back up to the brain. So they're very helpful. The other thing, a lot of patients find that practicing you know, relaxing type of exercises. Not that dysautonomia is caused by anxiety, but a lot of these patients have like very overstimulated nervous systems. So
right.
Practicing things
like hyper-responsive or maybe
right.
more visceral attunement. They're more attuned to what's going on in their bodies than perhaps other people
right,
are oblivious
right.
of what's going on.
So when you're not having a bad flare of your dysautonomia, sort of practicing, you know, relaxation, meditation, yoga, prayer, whatever it is that relaxes you, you know, try to do that a little bit every day. And it's not going to be a magic cure, but it kind of, it's like a coping tool. Pharmacologically, I'm probably leaving out a lot of the non-pharmacological mm-hmm. stuff, but
yeah,
we can circle back.
Yeah.
You talk a lot about on your website and your other podcasts about diet. So there's no like magic answer for this is the dysautonomia diet, mm-hmm. but a lot of patients report feeling better on, you know, an anti-inflammatory type of diet or a paleo or, you know, trying to cut out the junk food, maybe cut out dairy or gluten or wheat if it's bothering them. And really you just have to figure out what works best for you. There's no, you know, dysautonomia specific diet. But let's see.
Blood sugar control, I think, would play a role in that because when your blood sugar dips down very low, that triggers a shot of adrenaline, which it's been theorized that some people with POTS are hypersensitive to. It's almost like a hypersensitivity to your own adrenaline.
Yeah. Well, most people with POTS have excessive plasma norepinephrine.
Right.
Which is noradrenaline.
Right.
And it's not really known why. If it's an antibody thing, there are some genetic findings in a very small number of patients where they have a receptor problem with their norepinephrine. Mm-hmm. But most patients with POTS, almost everyone, has slightly elevated norepinephrine. And then some of the patients have very excessive norepinephrine, so high that they you know, have doctors thinking that they have
a tumor.
Pheochromocytomas
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
stuff, you know, and,
yeah.
and which they don't usually.
Right.
So those patients, they call that hyperadrenergic POTS. It's still part of POTS. It's mm-hmm. not a different diagnosis or anything. But there are also orthostatic hypotension elderly patients who end up being hyperadrenergic as well, which is a very new finding.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really know why this happens. But, yes, those patients definitely do better with, you know, controlling blood sugar. Also, eating smaller meals. A lot
right.
of these patients have terrible nausea and GI motility problems.
Mm-hmm.
So eating smaller meals throughout the day levels out the blood sugar and also doesn't put as much stress on your GI tract to have to push a large amount of food at once.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you eat a lot of food at once, blood diverts to your gut,
yes.
which takes it away from your brain and your heart
yeah.
to help you digest. So you want to keep those meals small if you're having lightheadedness after you eat.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So back to pharmacological fixes.
So common pharmacological approaches would include expanding the blood volume. So in addition to the salt and fluids, sometimes doctors add fludrocortisone, which mm-hmm. it's a steroid that is helps you retain sodium and swap out a potassium in your kidneys.
It's kind of like the opposite of an antihypertensive med. It's a hypertensive med.
It's the opposite.
Right.
So we tend to avoid diuretics if we have you know, lightheadedness or low blood pressure associated with the dysautonomia. It's called Florinef or fludrocortisone.
It's mineralocorticoid.
Sometimes used is desmopressin. Mm-hmm. Or DDAVP. I might be getting the acronym wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps kind of
fluid balance.
Sodium, increase the blood volume.
Yep.
Then we have vasoconstrictors like midodrine or sometimes phenylephrine or octreotide. Midodrine is much more commonly used.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a newer drug in the U.S. called Norstera that some people are using, which is droxidopa. It's not like a typical vasoconstrictor, but it actually upregulates norepinephrine and it increases blood pressure that way.
Hmm.
So, and then some of the patients take drugs to reduce their tachycardia,
mm-hmm.
like beta blockers or ivabradine, which is really interesting. Beta blockers tend to drop your blood pressure, so
right.
if you already have low blood pressure, you have to be careful. But ivabradine, apparently, been used in Europe for a while, and it was recently approved in the U.S. for heart failure. And we're hoping that there'll be some more research on it in autonomic disorders, but it seems to lower the heart rate without dropping the blood pressure.
Right, which you would want. You'd want to keep the pumping action of the heart going, but slow the heart so it's not going into tachycardia.
Right, right. And then there are a lot of other medications used, as I'm sure you know. Mm-hmm. There's so many medications that upregulate or downregulate different parts of the autonomic nervous system, and that's how they work. So you can sometimes use these drugs kind of creatively to treat a dysautonomia patient, but it's very individualized and it's hard. There's not a lot of research on using these drugs, in these autonomic disorders. So sometimes, the doctor's kind of guessing on the right dose mm-hmm. to give the patient. It's very frustrating to be that patient because you feel like a guinea pig. But
it is a matter of trial and error to some extent. I usually tell
the patients, if you're trying a new drug with your dysautonomia doctor, try to start out at a very low dose and then work your way up, because we tend to have weird drug sensitivities and kind of unusual reactions. We're not wired the way that the people they tested the drugs on are wired.
Yes, exactly. So in other words, you may have what are called paradoxical reactions or backward reactions. Drugs that produce one effect in normals can backfire in dysautonomia patients.
Yeah. I mean, not everybody. It's very unusual, some of the things we hear. And some of these patients have overlapping mast cell dysfunction or mast cell activation syndrome with their dysautonomia. And we don't really understand how those two things are connected. But there's some interesting research going on at the NIH where they think they've identified a gene that links POTS and some forms of, like, young person dysautonomias with mast cell dysfunction. And we're hoping that they're going to publish that soon, because it's something a lot of people, are looking forward to seeing in the literature.
Now, you yourself, you have a background in law. You have a JD degree. You're an attorney. But you have ventured into the arena of medical research yourself. You have a paper recently accepted on this subject. Could you tell us about that?
Sure, yeah. I've always been interested in science. When I practiced law, I was an environmental lawyer, and before that, I was an earth and space science and marine biology major, so I've always had a bit of science geek in me. And when I got sick, I looked, and there are some really great, super smart people doing research in this field, but there aren't enough of them. And you look at other diseases, and there's, 500 MS researchers out there doing really good work, and there's, like, three or four people seriously studying POTS. maybe 20 or 30 people studying, autonomic neurology in a consistent and serious way. So I have all of this autonomic stuff. It turned out to be caused by Sjogren's syndrome. And when we treated the Sjogren's syndrome, my autonomic symptoms got a lot better.
Hmm.
So I said, I'd really like to get involved with research on the autonomic component of Sjogren's syndrome. So I have this great neurologist here in New York, and every appointment I was, like, peppering him with research ideas instead of talking about my symptoms. And he was like, "Do you want to work on some research with me?" So we did. And our first paper, it's not his first paper, of course, but it's my first paper. It's an abstract at this point, and it's manuscript in progress. And it was accepted to the American Academy of Neurology for their spring meeting this coming year.
Cool.
And it's on, essentially, we looked for some novel Sjogren's antibodies, not the antibodies used for the formal diagnostic testing, but antibodies that are known to be associated with early Sjogren's syndrome. And we tested a whole bunch of dysautonomia patients for them, and we found that 41% of patients who have dry eyes or dry mouth, and then overall symptoms of dysautonomia, like lightheadedness, GI dysmotility, sweating problems, these patients, 41% of these dysautonomia patients had the early Sjogren's antibodies.
Mm.
So we think this is an area that needs more research. Of course, that's always the answer when you publish, is, well, we need more research after this. It looks like there's a lot of undiagnosed Sjogren's within the dysautonomia population. And I noticed that on the patient support groups. That's actually what made me really want to get involved.
I've written pretty extensively about something called mitral valve prolapse, which is thought to be an innocent heart murmur. But there's controversy about whether mitral valve prolapse may be related in some ways to forms of dysautonomia. Is that something that you have seen in the research?
Yeah, so the doctors who are who kind of specialize in autonomic neurology and autonomic disorders and some of the EPs that specialize in it, they kind of think, what they've told me, because I've asked them about this, because I have mitral valve prolapse since
I'm about
12 years old diagnosed, and it was never really a problem. You know, I just had it. It showed up on an echo or something. Anyways, they tell us that mitral valve prolapse syndrome is probably the old name for POTS.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And, you know, these phrases kind of come in and out of the vernacular of the medical sphere, right? Like, there are things we're probably calling, example, Civil War syndrome. That's POTS. We know that it's probably the same thing. You can look back in the literature. Hmm. It was called Soldier's Heart. It was called Acosta syndrome. So the names change. It's probably the same thing.
Or it used to be called Fainting Victorian Maidens. You know, that was a popular thing in the 1880s.
Right. I actually have a fainting couch. I got one, like, just for the fun of it.
Just when you decided to swoon, you know.
Right. Right. My husband is kind of cute, so. yeah, but I think that they think that mitral valve prolapse is probably not causing that systemic dysautonomia.
Mm-hmm. It's associated. A marker.
A finding. Yeah. And I had one cardiologist tell me that mitral valve prolapse is more likely to show up when you're hypovolemic.
Okay.
And if you're fully hydrated.
Yes.
So these patients with POTS are, many of them are hypovolemic, but it's not dehydration. Yeah. They're actually missing equal parts plasma and red blood cells.
And this could explain why sometimes I've had patients who said, well, you know, I was told I had mitral valve prolapse, and then I repeated the test, and then they said, no, you don't. It, to some extent, it's about interpretation of the image, but it also may relate to changes in hydration status. If you go into the test very dehydrated, you might accentuate the appearance of a mitral valve problem.
And I think there's probably a second potential link there. A good percentage of young dysautonomia patients also have something called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a collagen genetic collagen disorder, and they tend to EDS is a couple of different forms of collagen disorder, and it tends to make the blood vessels more susceptible to weaker, you know, essentially. So it could be that maybe mitral valve prolapse shows up more often if you have a collagen disorder. Maybe your valves aren't as tense as they should be. And so maybe that's a link. I've seen some of that in the literature. It's sort of up in the air. There's no, like, solid answer. But I think, you know, we discourage patients right now from calling it mitral valve prolapse syndrome because we don't want them to think that it's not the mitral valve problem causing your GI motility problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's your autonomic nervous system. So, yeah, that's, you know, but it's interesting. I saw that you had written a book on it. I actually was like, I got to order that.
Right. Well, the book actually, you know, it's about non-pharmacological interventions, and it, in many ways, mirrors some of the suggestions that that you made earlier. I noticed, you know, you list some research articles on this on your excellent website at dysautonomiainternational.org. One was intriguing. It was about reactions to the flu vaccine. I've actually seen a couple of cases where young gals have had really profound reactions to the Gardasil vaccine that have induced the onset of dysautonomia. So is there any linkage among susceptible individuals to, you know, throw them into a tizzy when they get a vaccine?
Yeah, well, we certainly hear this from some of the patients in our online patient community, which is a very big patient community. And we know, you know, I know of patients who had an onset, you know, within a few days of getting a vaccine. There are a couple of researchers and physicians, you know, clinicians who have raised the question in journal articles. They've kind of pointed some things out that are concerning them that they think needs more research. But there really isn't any, there's no conclusive, you know, the vaccine caused this problem.
Right.
But yeah, it's a question that should be answered. You know, there are patients who have, the timing of their onset is close to this. And like my own case, you know, I had a concussion onset if my symptoms showed up the day after my concussion, it's pretty common sense that the concussion probably caused it, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but it's, you know, it's obviously the vaccine question is very controversial and it has a lot of politics around
yep.
it. But we try to stay, you know, we say basically, you know, we need research on this to really know, and we shouldn't guess, and we
yep.
shouldn't jump to conclusions. And so we had actually discussed this with our medical advisory board, and their answer was, you know, we want to see some more research on this, and we're waiting to see. I guess the EMA, which is like the FDA of the European Union, was going to be doing a study, but then they didn't really do a study. They just kind of looked at what was already out there, and they kind of decided it was safe.
Right.
But that didn't seem like that wasn't like a
yeah.
prospective study,
yeah.
Which is probably what's needed.
Indeed. Okay, well, so you've raised some very, very important issues here, and our discussion's been most informative. What's today's intelligent medicine call to action vis-a-vis dysautonomia? What are some of the resources out there? First of all, of course, your excellent website, dysautonomiainternational.org. What will listeners find there if they look?
Lots of patient-friendly summaries, journal articles, videos, tips on where to go if you think you have this. It's very hard to find a doctor to properly diagnose it. So we have a map that has a list of doctors on the map that, you know, are skilled in diagnosing this and treating it. And so if you want to see if you have dysautonomia, come check out our website and find a doctor in your area. If you have dysautonomia, there's tons of online support. On Facebook is a big, you know, for a lot of diseases these days, patients are connecting on Facebook. If you're a medical professional listening to this, please, you know, read some journal articles and get
yep.
up to date on this, because we hear a lot of things where patients are told, like, you know, you don't have anything wrong with you. You're told it's totally normal for 12-year-old girls to be fainting every day.
Hmm.
Like, no, it's not.
I won't cut it. Yeah.
So we, you know, we politely and respectfully ask, you know, the medical community to kind of, you know, take measures to get up to speed on this. And if you want us to come lecture at your hospital or university, we are more than happy to try to get some of the neurologists or EPs that really specialize in this at places like Mayo Clinic and Harvard and the NIH. You know, they're very serious doctors, and they can come have a serious talk with your hospital about how to recognize these conditions.
Well, great stuff, and most informative, and a subject that we, in my many years of doing this show, we've never really breached. Thanks very much for your dedicated work on behalf of sufferers of dysautonomia. And
well, thanks so much for having me.
And congratulations on your, what seems to be perhaps not cure, but a modus vivendi or workaround that enables you to be so productive. Good for you.
Yeah, I get a lot of work done on the couch.
Well, it sounds like you're rolling with it. Thanks very much for being with us today. Lauren Stiles, president and co-founder of dysautonomiainternational.org. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.